presentation.
Hey there, welcome to No Flicks Given. Very special episode today. As a real quick primer before we get started, my name is Peter, by the way. With me today is Connor. Say hi, Connor.
Hello, Peter.
And we have Matt.
Good morning, afternoon, or evening.
There we go. Whatever you're doing while you're listening to this podcast, because we know it's not nothing. this is actually a paid-for episode. We aren't being paid to do this episode, but somebody has paid for this episode to happen, which is really exciting. Friend of the pod, Timmy Nelson, once and potentially future guest, hopefully. Fellow bird boy, caw-caw. He, in his spare time, helps run, or not run, but he participates in a charity called Extra Life. And Extra Life is a charity, if you don't know, where you basically pledge to play video games for 24 hours straight, and you raise money for children's hospitals to buy them games and entertainment for terminally sick children or chronically sick children who have long stays in the hospital. And so Timmy has raised tens of thousands of dollars at this point, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars. And he asked us this year if we would be willing to donate some things to be auctioned off or to participate in the charity somehow. And so we offered up a couple things, and this episode is one of those things. We let somebody select an episode for us to cover, select a movie for us to cover and talk about during this episode. So this is a reward for a charity. Somebody paid money for us to do this to help sick kids play video games. And that lovely individual's name is Natalie Wilson. She wanted us to do an episode about 1952's Singin' in the Rain. So,
thanks, Natalie.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Natalie. What a pleasure of a movie to be able to cover.
Yes.
To just in general, much less for a great charitable cause. Matt, how do you feel about Singin' in the Rain?
I thoroughly enjoy it. I am not convinced that it is a cohesive story, but that's not the important part. The important
that's not
part
what movie musicals were about.
Yeah, no, the important part is just watching old Hollywood just take you away to several dozen different places at the same time with dance and song and just like effusive joy for that period of movie making, which that I always forget that Singin' in the Rain's technically kind of a period piece because it takes place in 1927 and it's about like a major ground shift in movies. And I was, because I can't get it off of my mind right now, I will tell you right now, I did the math. If Singin' in the Rain were made today, it would take place in 1999, and it would probably be about how the Matrix has become really popular and CG's going to take over.
You know
everything.
What it would be about, Matt? It would be about Napster, probably.
It's the digital revolution type of stuff that I think the democratization of being able to make movies. The things that I forgot and then was
it'd be about Final Cut Pro.
Oh man.
Actually, yeah. No, the first movie to be cut fully on Final Cut Pro, from start to finish, if memory serves, like fully, like no film negatives at all involved.
Yeah.
I believe was Office Space, which came out
oh, shit.
In 1999.
You are correct.
Oh, God.
Mike Judge was a Final Cut Pro pioneer.
I actually kind of am a little bit jazzed about this idea of making a period piece about Hollywood in 1999 where you have like some of the best films ever being made by then sort of like young up-and-comers. Like, I mean, Matrix, Fight Club.
Fincher, the Wachowskis.
Office Space.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Link all these guys. Linkletter, and then like, oh, that, and then sort of parallel to that, you have like this growing indie scene, and with digital video, like an indie scene,
yeah,
going on in the background. Like, you could do like a whole like survey of filmmaking in 90. Oh, that's kind of cool, actually. It's, I kind of want to do that.
It's only a matter of time before it shows up in a vertically aspect ratioed phone near you.
Hi, my name is Andrew Baum, and I'm the product marketing manager for Final Cut Pro, an exciting new video creation tool from Apple Computer. It's got editing, effects, compositing, all in one package at a very, very affordable price. Why don't you come with me and check it out?
Connor, how do you feel about Singing in the Rain?
I love Singing in the Rain. Singing in the Rain, I saw it a little bit, not quite in childhood. And it is definitely one of my first like Hollywood film nerd kind of moments where like the idea of the transition from silent to talkies and that being a big deal. And then thinking about the technology that made it happen kind of caught me at a young age. I actually didn't see this movie until the summer after my freshman year of high school. And that is because in the spring of my freshman year of high school, I played R.F. Simpson in a production of Singing in the Rain.
That's amazing.
For the grand finale, they put me in a gigantic yellow rain slicker with the rest of the cast, but of course I'm me. I was a gigantic man in the back row, dancing poorly, as I do in all musicals that I'm in. And to this day, my parents can't stop laughing about it.
I love that. That's fantastic.
You could hear my father laughing in the audience. My father laughing in the audience.
Your father, notorious laugher. Yeah.
Yeah.
God.
And they had me gray my hair, so not insignificant number of people thought I was a teacher.
Dear Lord.
There's actually, we're missing Frank, but the other person that we're missing who I tried to cajole onto this show because they know way more about the subject matter than most people in this world, is my wife, who has her master's in musical theater, professor of musical theater. So I did ask her for some like quick notes and fun facts to share sort of about the movie and sort of what it means to musical theater and all that fun stuff. So one of the things that she points out is that this is effectively a jukebox musical.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The songs were written and performed long before the movie ever, you know, was a thing. It was... You know, songs were sung in reviews and other movies. Nacio Herb Brown wrote the music and Arthur Freed wrote the lyrics. And it is true that they liked the people who produced this movie really liked the songs. And they were like, whatever, just like make up a story. So they wedged like these songs into the story. Like Make 'em Laugh has no place in this movie. So Matt, your comment earlier about how there is really no plot, there really is no plot.
No.
If you're familiar with jukebox musicals, you know, they're all over the place. But
which is very funny because that's basically what they wind up doing at the end of the movie for the Dancing Cavalier.
Yeah. Oh yeah. and now speaking of songs that had existed before, we had this discussion specifically about Make 'em Laugh when we covered The Pirate because
I wanted to talk about this. Yes.
Because if and I think I have the order correct, is that Be a Clown from The Pirate is the original song and then this apes it, but they just didn't care because it was from The Pirate.
Make 'em laugh, make 'em laugh. Don't you know everyone wants to laugh? My dad said be an actor, my son. But be a comical one. They'll be standing in lines for those old honky-tonk monkey shines.
Correct. The, and Yeah, so here's a quote. So how Free could have written it in the first place and not realized is still a mystery. We have no idea, and we never brought it up with Arthur either before or after that day. It's fabulous, but the song's exactly like Be a Clown.
I remember watching The Pirate, and because I had been in Singing in the Rain, I had heard Make 'Em Laugh a billion times.
Yeah.
And thinking something was up. And doing the deep research to figure out what the hell was going on.
Which if you're confused about why we're talking about this, go back about a year and listen to our episode on The Pirate, which is a really fantastic episode, also featuring Gene Kelly in a movie musical. Also, not much plot there, but no. Man, are there some fun set pieces.
You got a great ass, and you got your head all the way up it. When I think of asses, something comes out of me.
I couldn't stop thinking today about the ending sequence with all of the old the lit Broadway theater lights in that one studio and just how oppressively hot it would have been with those types of bulbs.
Yeah.
Like you light a Christmas tree with old school bulbs for like 20 minutes and you can't touch it. And like they filled an entire black box with like just marquee after marquee and had people having to dance and sing all the way through it.
And the magic trick of that shot, too.
Oh.
Just like the camera pulling all the way out, and it's just sort of him surrounded by black, and then the lights start to come on one by one. That's the first time in a long time that I have been wowed by cinema.
So,
watching this down again.
Another fun fact specifically about Singing in the Rain, and this was the second fact that Jess asked me to share, was the song was introduced to Broadway in 1929 in a musical review, which was basically how a lot of composers just like put their stuff out there. There was no plot. It was just like
the song Singing in the Rain?
The song Singing in the Rain.
Okay.
And it was sung by Doris Eaton Travis. And Doris Eaton Travis is significant because she was the longest existing Ziegfeld girl. She was a Ziegfeld girl forever, long past, you know, when most people stopped being a Ziegfeld girl. So there you go. Little fun fact there. How would you describe the plot of Singing in the Rain to somebody if they haven't seen it?
I think it's just the base concept of the introduction of the talkie movie creates friction in the established order of Hollywood, and they have to scramble to try to be ahead or at least at the curve, and hilarity ensues, which is, I know, my usual tagline, but that's kind of what happens.
It's actually a really ripe subject matter because a lot of shit went down in that era when that transition took place, because like Hollywood wasn't that old, and it was still, I mean, like Los Angeles was kind of like still kind of like a four horse town.
Yeah.
At that point, and a lot of the technological stuff was coming out of New York, so you had a lot of people that had kind of just sort of like invented the film industry, having to pivot really hard into like a super technical process.
Yeah, you got to think MGM was founded in 1924. Yeah. The Jazz Singer comes out in 27, 3 years later. Like,
yeah,
the amount of change from like 1920. To 1935 is really hard to understate. Even to 1940, there's a huge jump. It's pretty wild.
And specifically the scene where Gene Kelly is getting laughed at for the "I love you, I love you, I love you" for the first talkie.
Yeah.
That actually happened to a guy. Like, that's based on a real thing that actually happened to somebody. Like, he had been the most famous star of silent films, and his acting just came off completely wrong because it's a different style of acting when you're acting for sound. And I'm conflating this with Babylon, because the same. Have you guys seen Babylon?
I have not.
No, I really need to see Babylon.
Babylon's great. It's a great time at the movies. The plot is essentially the same. They basically went back and made like a gritty, more honest, more sort of like hyped up version of the same period of time. And at the end, not to spoil anything, but Brad Pitt sort of plays the same kind of character Gene Kelly's playing. In that movie, when he gets laughed at, he goes to the bathroom and blows his brains out.
Oh, cool.
Spoiler.
It's funny having, I walked into Babylon having no idea what Babylon was about. But then having been in Singing in the Rain and spending so much time thinking about Singing in the Rain 24 years ago, my God, it was a captivating experience.
Never want to see that Lockwood and Lamont again.
Wasn't it awful?
This is the worst picture ever made.
I liked it.
So Matt, maybe take us through a real quick like history of why is this significant? Why is this particular time in Hollywood significant?
Specifically because of it's the Roaring Twenties, so the Depression hasn't hit yet. So we're showcasing opulence before anything else. But the fact of just kind of what we've been discussing of you have an entire industry that is based towards making film in a very specific way. There's a tracking shot that I love in this where you're walking through one soundstage and they're making six different movies because they can, because they don't have to worry about sound.
That actually is a really cool detail that they're all doing it at the exact same time. No regard of the noise, literally right next to each other, just out of frame. It's a really cool detail.
Yeah. And the fact of you make the fictionalized story of this particular studio and this creative crew dealing with this particular problem by turning it into essentially the first musical film and like showcasing everything that you can do. And because it's made in 1952, everything that you can do, not only with sound and music and choreography, but color. Because beyond anything else, this movie is also an hour and 45 minute advertisement for Technicolor.
Yeah, sure is.
Because there are very few costumes that are put in front of the camera in the 1927 films that would have really made sense without thinking about them in color.
And this is an era in Technicolor too, where they were just showing off like weird like the color choices were absolutely insane. They would put like purple next to green and orange just to show off that they could.
Yeah.
Well, the dream ballet sequence.
That's what I'm thinking of.
Holy smokes. First of all, that took up like 2/3 of the budget of the whole movie.
Mm-hmm. And the runtime.
Yeah. Yeah. But man, is that a, like that is a movie unto itself, just to let Gene Kelly just cook.
Yeah.
I in particular think of the sequence in the dream ballet with the woman that he's dancing with that long flowing piece of cloth that just goes off into infinity.
Yeah.
Mm. And how heavy that must have been to dance against.
Yeah.
Like, it's an incredible visual image.
And watching it turn through him and around him.
And the guys with the fans off screen that are sculpting the piece of cloth in real time. Cool. Like,
yeah.
Oh my God, that's fucking Hollywood filmmaking right there, man.
Yeah, it is very much a they do not make them like this anymore.
No. Yeah,
and sort of a little bit getting back to your earlier question, Peter, about like why this is a historically important moment. Hollywood had only really existed for in the neighborhood of like 15-ish years at this point.
They all got kicked out of New York.
Well, no, they didn't get kicked out of New York. They stole a bunch of shit and left.
Oh, wow.
Part of the reason Hollywood's in LA is because Edison was so litigious about his licensing of film equipment and film. If you wanted to make a movie, you had to pay Edison his fees to make it happen. So a bunch of people bought a bunch of cameras, figured out how to make film, and headed out west. Also, because you kind of in the Los Angeles area, you'd have enough sun so you could expose film correctly. So it basically started off of these like as these like camps that got. So you have a film industry that develops over time, and kind of becomes the first populous. I forget, but like for the masses, entertainment or art, you know, art. And entertainment thing. You had vaudeville up to this point where you had sort of small performance houses, but you didn't have anything that was like mass produced and you didn't really have mass media beyond newspapers.
Well, and the evolution from the Nickelodeon to the cinema house to you know, feature films is you know, sort of a jump all into itself.
Exactly. And this was also an era where movies were basically just disposable entertainments. Like, thousands of movies have been lost because they would burn the film prints to make space from storage.
Yeah.
Because, like, who cares? And part of the reason... And
celluloid burns real good.
Like, it sure does. Nitrocelluloid, oh, that goes up real fast. They also call that flash paper. Over time, because there are so many people seeing movies all the time, they're making money hand over fist. And I do love this image. And they do this a little bit in Babylon, but of this image of, like, of these, like, poor rejects from whatever part of the country out east they come from, coming out to L.A., and just kind of fucking around and, you know, working real hard, but sort of inventing this art style. But again, they start making money hand over fist. The studios get humongous. And part of the reason they get humongous is exactly that shot that you were talking about. They could produce so much stuff so fast. Mm-hmm. So you always had something new coming out in the theaters, and you always had a draw. Sound not only changed everything about, like, going and seeing a movie, about, you know, like the experience of watching a movie, it completely changed how movies got made.
Yeah.
There's a great movie called The Crowd. It's a silent film made by a guy named King Vidor and a bunch of other people. And there's a tracking shot in that film where you enter into a cafe. And you go across about...
Oh, I know this shot.
I put it in Beards of Industry.
Yes, you did.
You go across like 10 or 12 tables, and the magic trick of it is, like, the tables are actually cut in half, and the people sitting them are pulling them away.
As
they're pulling back.
It's a really cool shot.
It's been replicated and referenced a lot, but, like, that shot was, like, a thing you could do that year, and the next year it was impossible. Because you couldn't do camera moves like that in the era of sound. And it wasn't necessarily because you couldn't, like, attach the recording equipment or whatever. It's literally because the sound of the camera up, like, spinning would get picked up by the mics.
Yeah.
Initially, I mean, like, they would do stuff like build soundproof boxes for cameramen to be in.
Yeah.
And then eventually you would get these big blimps that would go over cameras to absorb all the sound. But you couldn't physically move a camera like that anymore for decades. So, yeah, changed everything in a pretty serious way. It also, the kind of celebrity that had been invented in the era of silent film, all that shit changed. Because if you're in Lena Lamont's situation, you have a funny accent, you know, or you're just not good at acting and speaking at the same time. Because... silent film acting is essentially pantomime. It's big, broad gestures, suggesting, you know, there's not a lot of subtlety in silent film. So everybody's techniques had to change to be able to make movies. And there was a big question if Hollywood could continue to be profitable, because it also had to be way slower. You know, you couldn't jam 15 productions right next to each other anymore. So it was a bigger change than going to color.
Well, and that also begins sort of the consolidation and the beginning of sort of the studio system, right? Where because they need so much money backing productions and sort of creating that space, you know, it becomes not monopolistic, but it does become consolidated among the groups.
Yeah, it was the beginning of the entrenchment of the biggest studios into what would become the Hollywood system 10-ish years later.
You had RKO, Paramount, MGM,
Warner Brothers.
That's kind of it for a while.
And a lot of other smaller, all of those other smaller players just kind of went away.
But I mean, the big systems really, you know, tied up the celebrities. And like mm-hmm. Gene Kelly, for instance, getting back to this actual movie, you know, this was kind of his part from MGM. I think this is the last movie he did with MGM. And MGM let him direct as a result to try and, like, keep him happy. And he was a nightmare of a director.
Gene Kelly, no.
Yeah, I know, right?
Consummate perfectionist.
Famously chill Gene Kelly?
Famously chill, regular old, hey, it's okay, Gene Kelly.
Poor Debbie Reynolds.
Debbie Reynolds, who was, like, 17 at the time, just, like, crying every night. and Donald Connor like trying to make her laugh.
To Fred Astaire.
I know.
Yeah, wasn't that the story where she, like, Fred Astaire found her crying underneath a piano?
Yeah,
because Gene Kelly was berating her
and helped her learn the choreography and everything. And then at the end of the Good Morning shoot, which had gone from like 8 a.m. until 11 p.m, her feet were bleeding.
Yeah,
yeah, they shot that like 60 times or something.
Yeah.
It was like 2 weeks or something to get the whole sequence.
Because Debbie Reynolds, when she shot this, her background was not in dance. She was a gymnast who was just like trying to make it work. So the story goes, when Fred Astaire was in the studio, he found Reynolds crying at her piano. On hearing what had happened, Astaire volunteered to help her with her dancing. Kelly later admitted that he had not been kind to Reynolds and was surprised that she was still willing to talk to him afterwards. After shooting the Good Morning routine, which had taken from 8 a.m. until 11 p.m. to shoot, Reynolds' feet were bleeding. Years later, she said, "Singing in the Rain and Childbirth were the two hardest things I ever had to do in my life."
Crazy.
What could I do to you? I'm only a shadow.
You keep away from me just because you're a big movie star, wild party, swimming pools. You expect every girl to find a dead faint at your feet. Well, don't you touch me.
Fear not, sweet lady. I will not molest you. I am but a humble jester, and you are too far above me. Farewell, little Barrymore. I must tear myself from your side.
So Gene Kelly was not easy to work with as a director, is what we're generally saying.
No. And I mean, if you look at any movie that Kelly does, though, and what he produces, you understand sort of why he is the way he is. And I guess it is that question of, is it sort of that maniac instinct that breeds excellence? Or is he just an asshole?
Yeah. Or is it a case of like, I'm not asking you to do anything that I wouldn't be doing myself. In fact, I am doing it.
He did shoot the song Singing in the Rain with like 104 degree fever.
Yeah. I mean, he's on a whole other level of like the type of movie star that we're discussing. This is before... All of this stuff would be unheard of today, and if it were heard of, there would be lawsuits.
I mean, and the things that he is capable of doing with his body are just I want to say like magic tricks, but that would be that would be devaluing them because magic tricks are inherently fake. And but while they are impressive, what Gene Kelly is doing is very much real.
Yeah. And I mean, all of the choreography, all of the just the control that he has. And it comes with that perfectionist streak, but like, whoo boy, you got to make sure that everybody who's with you is along for the ride. Otherwise it's going to be a bumpy fucking road.
I would love to know how many times they shot Make Him Laugh, because that to me is still the most impressive number in the whole movie.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that Don O'Connor does. And it's funny because, what it always reminds me of is, one of the times that Joseph Gordon-Levitt hosted Saturday Night Live, he opened SNL
with Make Him Laugh.
Yeah. And he does like 80% of the routine. And it's incredible and it looks really hard and the audience could not have given a shit.
Yeah.
if you go back and you watch that, the audience is kind of like, nah. There's no like standing ovation or anything. They're just like, it's okay.
It's
incredible.
Yeah, he runs up the wall twice in one continuous take, like just while singing and doing all of his other bullshit, and maintains perfect control and lands. I mean, Lord knows how many times they had to do it until he did it that way, but like capturing that on film is just a feat.
I don't remember now. I'm wondering, is there a cut?
There's a cut before he goes through the wall.
Through the wall. Okay. Okay. That was my next question.
But there's no cut in between the two actual ones.
Right. In my mind, it's all one seamless thing where he was able to do both the wall runs and then do a miraculous thing of just placing himself directly in the hole in the wall.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a moment in the movie where he does something simple like stand up, and I swear to God, I thought he was floating.
Speaking of people who do amazing things with their body in this movie, like, he's on another level of existence as far as all of the slapstick, like, just the control of everything that he's doing. And it's a much different wiry energy to it than Gene. So it's this great yin-yang thing going on at the same time, and it's they complement each other really well. You see it during the diction coach scene a lot.
Oh, Moses.
Oh,
Moses.
Yeah.
Supposes, is toses, a roses, but Moses supposes erroneously. A Moses, a Mose, a rose is a rose, a toes is a toes. Hoop-de-doo-de-doo.
His like, I'm just here to fuck around energy for the whole movie.
Yeah.
Doesn't change at all. It's great.
But it's there that I think he plays really well as the tie-on from the vaudeville era transitioning into talkies. Like, that is so vaudeville, the faces and the slapstick and all of that. It's really excellent casting, and he does really excellent work.
Was this Debbie Reynolds' first movie, or was she in something?
Yes.
Okay. Which is insane, by the way.
The person who's astounding is Gene Hagen.
Oh, God, she's great.
So Gene Hagen actually, she's Debbie Reynolds' singing voice for part of it.
Yeah. She dubbed at least two songs, right?
Yes. So the voice
irony
that she uses for I know, it's hilarious. The voice that she uses for most of the movie is just her character voice.
What do you know about it, you piano player? Are you anybody? Johnny, how can you let him talk to me like that? Your fiancé.
But her actual voice is, you know, incredibly good.
Nothing can keep us apart. Our love will last till the stars turn cold.
Which, you know, this got her an Academy Award nomination. And I think the movie only got two nominations for Academy Awards. And I don't think it won any.
That is insane.
It was very lukewarm, according to what I was reading. Like, it wasn't what we think of it now. It was very much just like, oh, it's another Gene Kelly picture, great. And then people moved on. And now it's essentially, for people our age and in that realm, like, this is the Gene Kelly movie.
So it was nominated for, specifically the title of the category is Scoring of a Musical Picture.
God.
So, best score and supporting actress. But Donald O'Connor did win a Golden Globe for best actor in a motion picture, musical, or comedy.
Oh, good for him.
Yeah.
Good for him.
Yeah.
I didn't know they had the Globes back then.
Yeah. Globes are old.
And watching Gene Hagen's performance now, too, I'm also trying to figure out, like, this is entirely how we get Harley Quinn at this point.
Oh,
like,
for sure.
Oh,
yeah.
Man. Yeah.
Like, yeah.
That is the direction in the sound booth in the early 90s when that character is introduced. It's just like, yeah, this.
Look alive, wage slaves, presenting the one and only Joker!
We can make a fool out of Lena Lamont! We can make a laughing stock out of Lena Lamont! What do they think I am, dumb or something?
Oh, God.
Here's the problem, too, is that because, again, this is a, you know, popular musical film, this is ingrained into my wife Katie's existence, and so she knows all of the lines the way that I know Star Trek lines, so there's a lot of shit like that getting dropped around the house from time to time, even when we're not talking about the movie. We're just like, hey, what's the big idea?
I can't I can't.
That poor woman trying so hard.
The reveal of that is very funny, because if you remember when he's giving his interview,
she doesn't say anything.
They won't let her talk.
With the press pool, she keeps trying to talk, and he will not let her.
Yeah.
It's hilarious.
Dignity. Always dignity.
Oh.
Dignity.
Dignity.
Yeah.
Dignity. Always dignity.
Funny enough, that was my only note that I had when I was starting to make notes for this movie, and I just quit after that.
Yeah. That's fine.
At a certain point when Gene Kelly's, like, escaping from Gene Hagen, like, he jumps into Debbie Reynolds' car. And in a very strange sequence, like, sort of flirts with her because she's an actress from New York that had, like, just come out to LA.
Yeah, it's the antagonistic meet cute.
Yeah. Yeah.
As was the style.
She believes that true actors are on the theater because they get to talk and they know lines and have command of the English language, and they have that little debate before she says she's here for the serious stuff, and then they split for about 3 minutes until we find her again.
Yeah. I actually don't recall how she comes back in.
Wait, she, seriously?
You don't, Peter?
Oh, as the showgirl, as the birthday thing,
she's,
right?
Yes, she's the one in the cake.
Well, if it isn't Ethel Barrymore. I do hope you're going to favor us with something special tonight.
Please.
Say, Hamlet's soliloquy, or the balcony scene from Romeo and Juliet.
Oh,
don't be shy. You make about the prettiest Juliet I've ever seen.
All I do is dream of you the whole night through.
Just cramming every dance number they possibly could into this fucking thing.
You know those like deeply long-held memories that are very vivid but don't become vivid until they're activated?
Yeah.
The All I Do Is Dream of You the Whole Night Through song was definitely a song that I found a little grating when we were rehearsing.
On the 12th
Singing
time,
in the Rain.
Yeah,
yeah. And because it was designed to be.
It wasn't Beautiful Girl.
I still don't know what the context is for Beautiful Girl in the universe of the movie.
So actually, here is the context.
Oh, God.
The context is that it is an homage to Ziegfeld.
Oh,
it is,
okay.
It's a Ziegfeld review. It is one dude singing with a bunch of beautiful women in like couture gowns, just kind of standing there,
yeah.
And then eventually like surrounding him and kind of fawning over him.
Yeah,
because that was entertainment in the '20s.
Yeah,
hey, that dude Ziegfeld knew what was up, man.
Yeah,
he knew entertainment.
A million New Yorkers can't be wrong.
That's true.
So, long story short. They convert the movie into a talkie. As we alluded to earlier, the early like test screenings do not go well, and so they scramble to turn it into a musical where they overdub Gene Hagen's lines with Debbie Reynolds, and including dream ballets and romances and Good Morning, the song Good Morning, for
yeah.
no reason.
Yeah.
That's just there. That just happens.
Yeah.
Yeah, they really pushed it too, of just like having to set it up of like, it's 1:30 now. It's totally not night anymore. Guess what we have to sing?
Exactly. Yeah, and that's kind of the movie. Like
Yeah, it's not like I said, the plot is whatever. It's the spectacle of just watching human beings dance and like do all sorts of weird shit in front of the camera.
But man, is it good.
Yeah.
Like this is it's easily top 5 if not top 3 movie musical of all time.
Yeah.
And it still holds up in that regard.
Yeah, I mean it's just well crafted. Everybody knows what they're doing. Because it's a jukebox musical, all of the songs for the most part are earworms. So you there's never like the song that's just there to get you from scene B to scene C. It's the
yeah.
movie exists for the catchy song. So like everything
right. The dialogue and story are for getting you from song one to song two.
Which I would almost argue makes this like an anti-musical.
The music isn't really expressing anything about what the characters are going through?
It's breaking all of the rules, but is a musical nonetheless.
The general rule for musicals is that you sing when the emotion is too big to just be said. So... in this case, you're kind of right. Like they don't actually sort of build on the motivation for the emotion to grow. It's just kind of like, hey, it's time to sing this song.
Except for Singing in the Rain.
Yes.
Right.
Singing in the Rain
right.
has a lot of motivation. Well, and you could argue that like the dream sequences, they have enough motivation.
It's a pitch though. Like the whole the framing reference is just like, and I'm going to tell you.
I forgot that was.
Yeah. Like the whole thing is like. He's like, we're going to watch this Broadway kid in New York trying to make his way before he gets hit in the head with a sandbag. And then like you're watching, you're like, all right, he's the kid in Broadway trying to make it. And now he's in a sunset suspended by a woman, and I don't know what's happening anymore. And there's gangsters flipping large coins, and sure. And there was
gotta dance, gotta dance, gotta dance.
And there's a jump cut with the woman in the green dress because the Catholic League objected to something that happened in between those two cuts.
I forgot about that.
Yeah. We're watching it, and I was like, oh, I visibly like jumped when I saw the cut because it snapped me out of it. I was like, something happened there. Either somebody fucked up a take or whatever. And then Katie was looking it up later. She's like, yep, it was a decency thing. They objected to the handsy.
Turns out Gene Kelly actually introduced the world of grinding, and they cut it out.
Yeah. What a different world that we would live in if they had kept it in.
I remember watching this the first time, and this was after having been in the production of Singing in the Rain, and realizing the degree to which that Broadway rhythm is just fucking madness.
Yeah.
A complete non sequitur in the film. It reads weirdly better on stage. Don't know. It doesn't feel like it goes on for as long. That's the other thing. This movie is only 103 minutes long.
Yeah, it is not a long movie.
Hour 43.
Yeah, hour 43, and like the Broadway rhythm section is like 20 minutes.
Oh, at least. Yeah.
It's a big chunk of that runtime.
The Broadway section is 20 minutes. The intro piece where we're watching the montage has got to be at least 10, 15 minutes. Like,
yeah.
The actual story itself is, again, just there as a vehicle for songs.
I do like the Hollywood behind the scenes dynamic and the energy that all our characters share between each other. There's something that I found extremely charming about R.F. Simpson, the studio head, getting in a huddle with Gene Kelly and Bob O'Connor, Don O'Connor.
Sensational. Cosmo, remind me to give you a raise.
O.R.F.
Yes?
Give me a raise.
So you know what other two movies this made me think of is Hail Caesar.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And Hail Caesar owes a lot to this movie.
Yes. Hail Caesar is like a gritty retelling of this movie almost. The other movie is Mank. I don't know if you guys saw Mank. Mank is really good. Mank is about the creation effectively of Citizen Kane. But it does do a lot of sort of behind the scenes with the studio system and MGM and Warner Brothers and sort of like how the studio system sort of operated in actuality. So it's kind of the gritty version of this movie, but still just as entertaining, just for different reasons. It's a cool piece of theater history that really does hold up.
Yeah.
No, very much so.
Yeah, very, very much so. Actually, not to spoil the ending of Babylon again, the movie Babylon ends with one of the main characters of the film who like was one of these guys that started as a PA and worked his way up to be like the head of the studio kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then his life gets ruined and he has to skip town.
Of course.
And it ends with him in a theater in 1952 watching Singing in the Rain, being like, oh, it was all worth it.
Oh, God.
And then it ends with a really pretentious montage.
I've heard a lot about the montage at the end of Babylon, and that's like mostly what I've heard about the end of Babylon.
I have a lot of mixed feelings about Babylon.
I very much prefer the Singing in the Rain's tongue-in-cheek brand of Hollywood jerking itself off, as opposed to some of the more
self-congratulatory,
still self-masturbatory, but just like not nearly as like funny or lighthearted and self-deprecating.
Yeah, I do appreciate that about this movie. Like, there is an edge of Singing in the Rain where it's like Hollywood's dumb. It's full of dumb people with dumb problems and should not be taken seriously.
Yeah, that side doesn't show as more anymore, or like.
No.
The people who are making the movies don't seem to either appreciate or care to highlight the irony of all of it. What was the movie that fake won the Academy Awards the other a couple years ago?
Hollywoodland?
La La Land.
Oh, La La Land.
Yeah. La La Land. But like that was not for me.
Speaking of movies that won't win the Academy Award, So the movie's written by Adolph Green and Betty Comden, who are a historic writing duo. And they actually feature as fantastic characters in the movie Maestro, which I don't know if you guys have seen that yet.
I am.
They get like a 5-minute scene at a dinner party where they're just like an act while Leonard Bernstein plays the piano. And they, of course, they help Leonard Bernstein write On the Town. I think they did the book for On the Town. Kind of a cool little note there.
It does harken back to a time when, especially in the realm of music and that genre and musicals, like the relationship between Broadway and Hollywood was different, but almost more symbiotic than parasitic the way it kind of is now.
Well, back then you had the star of stage, screen, and radio.
Oh, man.
And they all kind of had to do everything.
The first triple threat.
She can't act, she can't sing, and she can't dance.
Oh, God, what a clever movie this is, too. Like, it is easy to think of any given musical as sort of like a shallow entertainment, but again, like the and a lot of this is just sort of in the performance as well as the staging. But the way that they, especially Gene Kelly and Don O'Connor, sort of like express what they know without saying what they know is really like, just with a look or like a turn away from camera is really just beautifully executed and adds a layer of cleverness to this movie that like functionally doesn't really need to be there. I think that's what makes Singing in the Rain special is like it is kind of a smarter version of what could be a very sort of like shallow surface level exercise.
There's the underlying current of like technically Gene Kelly's, we're going to change him a little bit from being a cad to again, like finding love, but that's kind of secondary or even tertiary to what's really going on. Yeah. I mean, this was the first time I saw this was in a college film course for the history of film. Like this is one of the movies that you should watch, like if you're talking about the history of movies, because not only is it a piece of movie history, it is chronicling another moment in movie history.
I remember when the AFI like 100 years 100 films list came out back in the late 90s, this was very near the top as one of the best films ever made.
Yeah,
and I think it's routinely still considered the best movie musical. I think if you just like narrow it down to musicals, I think this is still number one.
Yeah, it's certainly the best one of these where it's like very studio, like in the studio-y, the very set PC, much more about execution than it is about narrative, you know?
Yeah.
Which is not to say that the narrative isn't interesting, it's just not the main concern.
You're in this for the spectacle, which is fine.
Yeah. Yeah,
but you also just you can't tell the history of movies without this movie.
Yeah,
well, and it's a great jumping off point for so many other things in movie history about not just the plot points of like the change in from silent film to talkies, but just like Gene Kelly. Oh yeah, you've never heard of Gene Kelly? Let me tell you about Gene Kelly. Or like Debbie Reynolds. Oh, let me tell you about Debbie Reynolds. Do you know who her daughter is?
Did you guys see the movie Cats Don't Dance? 1997 animated movie.
No.
I've seen the trailer for it.
I don't know. I've seen the trailer.
So this movie was a staple in my house and might be the subject of an episode later down the line. But this movie is basically the animated anthropomorphic animal version of Singin' in the Rain. And it's wonderful, and more people should know about it.
You can do anything.
This spring, Turner Feature Animation introduces you to some new characters you'll love in a story that could only happen in the movies. It's about a cat named Danny. He's got a dream. He's going to Hollywood.
Hollywood, where the streets are paved with gold.
And he's ready to dance his way to the top.
And what's funny is that Gene Kelly actually, he consulted on the film as a choreographer, even though it was all animated.
Huh. Huh.
And I believe he died right before the film was released in 97.
Huh. I think the Corridor Crew guys did an animation history thing on this as well. I think there's some cool animation technique. Scott Bakula plays the main character. Star Trek Scott Bakula.
God. The guy who directed it, Mark Dindal. The movies he directed, Cats Don't Dance, Emperor's New Groove.
Oh.
And Chicken Little.
I was about to say, I want to know what that guy's relationship with Disney is, and turns out, not great.
Yeah, no.
I mean, he's in post-production for the new Garfield movie. So there you go, starring Chris Pratt.
You hate to see, oh God, I didn't know no. that. Yeah, I was about to say you hate to see it, but you really do hate to see it, don't you?
The voice cast of this movie is Chris Pratt, Samuel Jackson, Hannah Waddingham, Ving Rhames, Nicholas Holt, Cecily Strong, Harvey Guillen, Brett Goldstein, and Bowen Yang.
Yeah, don't you see the danger, John, inherent in what you're doing here? You read what others had done, and you took the next step. You didn't earn the knowledge for yourselves, so you don't take any responsibility for it. You stood on the shoulders of geniuses to accomplish something as fast as you could, and before you even knew what you had, you patented it and packaged it and slapped it on a plastic lunchbox, and now you're selling it. You're going to sell it.
So here's the thing. I'm never going to see this movie, but I feel like I am worse off for you making me aware that it does exist.
And I mean, there is one thing in saying, oh, they're making an animated Garfield movie. Yeah, they do that every once in a while.
It's set to come out this May. You're welcome.
And then the 1-2 punch of, and it stars Chris Pratt.
Yep.
Is just
well, my first thought was like, oh, I guess Bill Murray's looking for another vacation home or something. But what a better movie to watch and not have to spend nearly as much money or time or effort to see is Singing in the Rain.
Yes. So watch also Singing correct. In the Rain. If you have the ability to watch Singing in the Rain, you should watch Singing in the Rain. It's a great night at home.
It's great.
And it's an hour and a half.
Yeah, it's
you're in, you're out.
Yeah. It's not a giant, you know, chunk of your day. It's very low stakes.
Yeah.
And it's just all spectacle. Like I've seen this movie several times and even watching it now, I was watching it and not like even thinking about looking at my phone, because like if you're not paying attention to what's going on, you're missing the fun of the movie.
So I actually didn't tell when I only saw it for the first time about 2 years ago.
No shit.
Really?
Yeah. It's actually a really distinct memory because Jess was pregnant and she found out that I hadn't seen it like all the way through. Like I've seen Make 'Em Laugh dozens of times, and I've seen Singing in the Rain as clips, yeah. But I hadn't seen the whole movie. And she was mortified and was like, I will not bring a child into the world without you seeing this.
My son's father cannot not have seen Singing in the Rain.
Exactly. And I mean, I fell in love with it. Like,
yeah,
this is to me an ideal movie musical. Like, it's wonderful.
Movies, everybody. Fucking movies.
Yep.
It's
magical.
It's the best. It's the best. I love movies. Hey guys, I love movies.
That's kind of why we're doing the show. Listen, this was such a fantastic suggestion from Natalie. Mm-hmm. I'm so happy I got to spend this time here talking about Singing in the Rain with you guys, and a fantastic cause for Extra Life. Like, it feels good, mm-hmm, knowing that this episode actually is going towards helping kids in bad situations get a little entertainment in their lives, and good for everyone all the way around.
If folks are interested in donating individually, where would they find them?
Yeah, so if you want to donate, I think you can just go to extra-life.org. I think that you know, it happens about once a year, generally in the fall. So I know we'll alert people when sort of the big drive comes again. But you can absolutely donate separately on your own if you want. And maybe we'll do something live or kind of special with Timmy when he does it again. That could be fun. So yeah, thank you again to Natalie.
Yeah, thank you, Natalie. This was great.
This was awesome. And thank you to Timmy Nelson for being a mensch and setting up his extra life. We're happy to be a part of it.
And thank you, dear listener.
And thank you for listening in. And thank you to Connor and Matt here. And play us out, Gene Kelly.
I'm singing in the rain. Just singing in the rain. What a glorious feel. And I'm happy again. I'm laughing at clouds so dark up above. The sun's in my heart and I'm ready for love. Let the stormy clouds chase everyone from the place. Come on with the rain, I've a smile on my face.
I'm singing in the rain,
just singing
in the rain.
What a glorious
feeling, I'm happy again.
All right, all right.